is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Scotland, Edinburgh, Simon Constable. Reporting for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, Forbes, and Time Magazine and other distinguished publications. Right now, all of the United Kingdom is under a storm named Barra. And Simon tells me it's raining in Edinburgh. So that is an atmosphere in which a stroll to the immediate past is worthwhile, because it turns out this is an anniversary of sorts, a catastrophe, a financial catastrophe 20 years ago right now. That's right. That's enough of a test. Simon, a very good day to you. Thank you for this. Enron, what was it? What happened 20 years ago that was a blow to the financial institutions and remains part of the story of going to market? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Yeah, this is really interesting. This happened just a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks, and it really affected Wall Street again. So it was like the second punch for Wall Street after Wall Street had recovered somewhat. At least it got its operations back going. Enron was an energy company, and it was a rather innovative energy company in many ways. Unfortunately, that included some creative accounting, which ultimately led to the company going bust. They got hit with a $40 billion lawsuit by the shareholders. The company had $63.4 billion in assets, and that made it the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history at that time. It was superseded a few months later by another company. Some of the senior executives went to jail for fraud and other things. It was really, really interesting, but I mean, that's one thing. It did a number of things. First of all, it shook the credibility of the U.S. market, which had long been the most credible market in the world to invest in. The idea that things would not be as they seem in financial accounts was something that most people never questioned when it came to Wall Street. Other places in the world, yes, and I'm not going to name any, but other countries had stock exchanges that were a little bit dodgy, and you knew that there were bigger risks, but not the U.S. So that was bad. So that was a big knock. And what we've seen since then is a couple of things. One is we've seen new rules introduced called the Sarbanes-Oxley rules, and these involve tons and tons and tons and tons and tons, and I can't over-exaggerate this, just loads of paperwork for companies to file and disclose, and it just adds enormous costs to going public. So that part of that is really quite interesting, in that the number of public companies in the U.S. has fallen since then, and it's steadily fallen to a level that we haven't seen since the 1970s. And that was when the U.S. economy was much, much smaller. So it's a little over 4,000, and the height was in the late 90s at over 6,000 companies. So that really is a big change. Then you've also got companies not being very risk tolerant. They don't want to take any risks because the top executives could go to jail if they get something wrong, and they don't really know what the penalties will be. So that's another thing. We're seeing companies stay private for longer. When Yahoo went public in the 1990s, that was a little less than a billion. When Facebook went public, it was much, much, much bigger than that. Let me get the number for you. It was 104 billion IPO value in 2012 versus less than a billion 20 years, or not even 20 years earlier. And the IPO value for Uber was 82 billion, and then you look back at Netscape, which was 2.9 billion. That was in the 1990s. So companies are just remaining bigger, and that has actually shut out the small investor. So the small investor hasn't been able to invest in these things because they haven't been public, and therefore they've lost out on the gains. And that has certainly been a contributory factor to rising wealth inequality. A lot went on. This has all happened, and it's going nowhere. It's going to stay the same because of one event and one company. And I'm sorry to go on like that, but it is a huge issue.
The observation then, it's easy to forget where we came from. The observation then appears that bigness is now the result of Sarbanes-Oxley. that companies wait much longer. And there's a private investment market. We've heard for a long time when new money is raised for a new company, it suddenly gains in value from X number of billion to Y number of billion. And I've puzzled why that system and why not the other. And now you explain it.
Yes. And you need, and the other thing is you need to be big to afford loads and loads, rows and rows, offices after office of attorneys and very high-priced attorneys who are going to keep you and your company out of jail. That costs a lot of money. It's no good doing it on a shoestring anymore because, you know, the company might be in violation of some rules that they didn't know about, or the bosses might go to jail. So it's a great disincentive to go public, and that really costs us all.
You spoke with Robert Wright, a senior fellow at the American Institute of Economic Research and an historian. Did you learn, are there complaints about the companies that require a longer time before they go public, if so? Or is it to their advantage? You know, you join a parade and you go along with it. So you can game any system. The companies themselves, do they embrace this new day?
Well, I think they do embrace it in some ways because they, you know, they know they have limits on what they've got to do. I think anyone who's been in the markets long enough would not be embracing it. But CEOs come and go very quickly these days. If a CEO lasts more than 5 years, it's a major event. A lot of them just get tossed out. I don't think the actual companies are complaining. They're just thinking it is what it is, and what can they do? And the way that this was sold in late 2001, early 2002 was, we've got to protect people. Now, who wants to be against protecting the small investor, even though it's hurt them? But nominally, it's about protecting the small investor. No one wants to stand up and say that. They want to say, oh, well, actually, it doesn't, because that sounds wrong. It sounds like big business just wanting to do what it does. It isn't true, but there you go.
Simon, the other part of it is Sarbanes-Oxley encourage the opportunity for the insider to put money into a new company quite separate from what the public can do? So the VIPs are favored. The rich get richer because they have access to private investment.
Absolutely. So you have something called qualified investors, and they tend to be people with high incomes or lots of assets or are very sophisticated. Those three things tend to go together. And if you're not in that qualified investor group, then you can't invest in private deals so easily. And yes, basically it's a club. If you're part of that club, it's great because you get a big bite of the cherry during the fast growth stage of companies. So when you think about the very fast growth stage of Facebook and Uber, that came before they went public.
Right.
And that's great. If you're already rich, you get even richer. And I'd love to be in that club, and I'm sure you would too.
Simon Constable is also going to guide us to a new term of art that I hadn't realized. I didn't know what it meant, writing for the Wall Street Journal. Simon, what the heck is fiscal space? It sounds like double talk.
It does sound like double talk, which is why I was so interested in it. This was from the column in translation that I write for the Wall Street Journal. And what it measures is how able is the government to be able to borrow in the financial markets in the event of a crisis, i.e. is there fiscal space for borrowing? And we look at that. And in normal times, it was very easy to tell. Low interest rates typically meant that investors were happy with it because investors were the people buying most of the bonds, the treasury bonds, to fund, you know, funding the crisis, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that was true back in the financial crisis, but it wasn't true last year because the majority of the money in the US and Canada that was raised by the US government came from the Federal Reserve, which basically was printing money to soak up the debt issuance. So do they have fiscal space? Yes, it wasn't all the money. Some of it was still coming from private investors. So there is some fiscal space in the US, but less than there was a decade and a half ago during the financial crisis. Now, when we go over to Europe, and this is really interesting, a couple of countries stand out as really having less than zero fiscal space, and they are Italy and Greece. And it turns out that their debt issuance was more than covered by bond buying from the European Central Bank. And they had to buy more than these countries were issuing or borrowing because a lot of foreign investors were pulling their money out. This points to fiscal instability in Italy and Greece, and it's a big problem. They had a bit more than 100% each in terms of their borrowing. Zero negative fiscal space for them. Bad news.
Fiscal space also, in my mind, includes the future. What fiscal space is in the future. And I don't want to misuse the term, so I'm going to drop it and walk over to the old-fashioned word. Inflation haunts the planet right now. And come home to the United Kingdom and come home to Scotland. We talk about inflation routinely here on this side of the Atlantic. Is that also true in Scotland and in the UK? Is inflation a worry now?
Inflation is a big worry now. The Bank of England has issued a warning that above 5% inflation is going to be the norm for a little while. That's pretty frightening. We're seeing workers get particularly stressed and demanding more money in a period. We've had decades of very limited strike action, industrial action in the UK. So a lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people are worried about folks who can't afford food or as much food as they would possibly want. It's a problem. It is something that people talk about all the time, and it's difficult to know what the government can or will do, especially given what's going on with a lot of other things in the economy at the time being.
Yes, let's turn to the UK economy and also the virus, which is right now walking in the same path as all of the recovery, the unknowns of Omicron. Simon Constable, he is in Edinburgh, Scotland, reporting for The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, Forbes, Time Magazine, and other distinguished publications. But we're going to go, when we come back, to Scotland now in Storm Barra and the prospect of Omicron returning us to the past again about mandates. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Can you hold on one moment? I just need to go get the front door. One moment. I'll be right back.